Ladies and gentlemen, the premier of the Western Cape, the best run province in South Africa.
Your opening speech as a premier, you said you wanted to be remembered as the premier of jobs.
In the last 5 years in South Africa, actually 404,000 new jobs. 360,343 of those jobs in the Western Cape.
That's 90%. How do you take what you've done here? How do you take that national?
If Joburg doesn't work, the Western Cape doesn't work. We have to make it work. It's like, this is not an option. Fix Joburg and Gauteng. That's what we've got to do.
We are delighted today to have with us the premier of the best run province in South Africa, Alan Windey.
Africa.
Fact check right there. Premier Alan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, it's only a pleasure. It's great to be here.
It's did you cycle here or did you actually take an Uber?
No, I actually got driven here.
Okay.
I wish I could have cycled today.
Yeah.
I tried to cycle, yesterday morning I cycled before work. Mm-hmm. This morning I had an early morning meeting with a public service commissioner. So couldn't get my cycle in.
I often heard the stories of how you give your VIP guys such a headache with when you go cycle because you don't really want to have them around you. Or either they can't probably cycle to keep up with you.
Okay, but I mean, normally my early morning cycle, I don't have anyone with me. And weekends, I don't cycle with them. I always say they're welcome to cycle with me if they can cycle
keep up.
Every time they get I get a guy that's like really hot at cycling, then they seem to move him to somewhere else. I don't know if that's a strategy or not.
It's probably a strategy. Premier, let's start in the beginning. Talk to us about your upbringing, where you were born. What was that like?
I can't remember. 60 years ago. I was born in Joburg. Jersey. I was born outside of Joburg near Mulder's Drift.
Grew up
on a small farm.
Mm. Yeah.
And my mother was the farmer. It was an organic fruit farm, mainly peaches. Probably one of the earliest organic farms at that stage. Mm. My father was a founding member of the Organic Soil Association, although my mother was the farmer. My father had factories. And so I grew up on a farm. The best place ever to grow up is to grow up on a farm.
Mm. Sure. And did you also go to school Kalfoot? I guess that's probably that era.
Yes. It started off Kalfoot, and then I remember I went to Boskop Primary. I still remember we used to play these games where you'd undo the laces on your shoes and then see how far you could kick your shoe because it was better to not have shoes on. And I managed to kick my shoe, well, one of my shoes to the roof of the double story component of the school. So now my shoe was gone. And I still remember how cross my mother was when I came there with one shoe and bare feet. Where the hell are your shoes?
Okay, so you didn't actually win that one, you lost.
No.
And how do you make your way from Mulder's Drift to Cape Town?
So,
or to the Western Cape?
Yeah, when I was at school still, and my parents decided to move to the Garden Route. Mm-hmm. I still remember God giving an option. Do you want to finish school in Joburg or do you want to finish school in Knysna? I said, no, I'm coming to Knysna. So then I majored in surfing and diving and water skiing and all the other things that go with when you move to the coast. But it was great. And then sort of spent my last years at school in Knysna. Then I joined the Navy.
Ooh.
And then I went back to Knysna and I started businesses.
Sure.
So I spent 10 years starting companies, at 10 companies between myself and my wife. And, she wasn't my wife then, but we started companies. And then I got involved in politics.
10 companies. What industries, what were you doing?
Oh, there were no specific. I had a bicycle shop. I had sign and screen printing, number plates. kites, resin molding.
Wow.
Yeah, all sorts. Tour very company, travel agency.
And I mean,
that was my wife mainly.
But where did this all start? I mean, surely, I know your mom being a farmer.
If you grew up on a farm, yeah.
Okay. Entrepreneurial skills right there.
With a plan mark.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it was because I saw what happened on a farm, but I also got to see what happened on an assembly line in my dad's business. I could see the manufacturing component. And so, I grew up with it. I grew up with, going, if I was on a Saturday with my father, we'd be in a shopping center. I still remember one day he bought this yogurt machine. And we get back home, and my mother is all excited. Yeah, you bought us a yogurt machine. And he said, no, it's not for you. And then he promptly took it to pieces. And he said, I want to see if I can make it.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of the place that I grew up in.
That's a plot twist. I did not see that coming. out of curiosity, what did your dad make in his factories?
So when we were in Joburg, it was sandblasting equipment, mainly for the mines. Mm. But we also made angle poise lamps. So if you can imagine this mic stand, but it's got a lamp on it, or the Pixar logo.
Yeah, logo.
Those are angle poise lamps. Fishing equipment, plastic molded fishing equipment. Mm. So yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, this probably shows as to why you loved being the premier of jobs.
Yes. Indeed, the jobs premier or the CEO premier.
So having all these, having that background and then my own to say, well, I'm sure I could start that, or I'm sure I could make that, or I'm sure we could do that. And then we'd start manufacturing it, and then I'd refine the assembly line. And just, I think, because of the background. I think it's a bit more than that. It's about growing up in a family where, you know, you'd be having dinner at the dinner table, and then you'd listen to your mom and dad talking about the bank or the overdraft or the customer that's not paying or the, you know, the some issue in production. And that gives me hope for entrepreneurs for the future, because, you know, there's so many young kids grow up, even if you're growing up in a family who's got a spaza shop, you are growing up amongst commerce and industry. You know, it's about buying and selling. It's about customers and customer service. Those are the seeds that get planted. And then it tells a young person that I can do this as well. I can buy something and add to it and sell it.
But, you know, looking at entrepreneurship now and then, I mean, what are some of the things that are different or that you pick up? Because, you know, when you read the stats, you find that the life cycle of a business today is, I think, not more than 5 years. But what are some of the things that you notice?
So if you make it to 5 years, you're going to make it. Those first 2 years are probably the hardest. And then 3 to 5, that's your, if you can establish a business between that stage, then you are going to survive. And they always say that, you know, the failures are how you learn. Unfortunately, one thing that didn't happen to me is I didn't go bankrupt in any of the companies, although I did close one because it wasn't the right thing. One business I had sold seashells. It was a gift shop and curio type shop in a coastal town. And then I remember going on holiday to the Maldives and seeing these seashells in their natural habitat. And I thought, I can't be part of the pillaging of these reefs. So we came back and we said, okay, we're closing this business down. I can't do that.
Sure.
But the other ones all worked. And so, I mean, that's a great thing on one side, but I never had those lessons of failure. But I mean, in business, you have the lessons every single day because you're employing people. You're having to make it at the end of the month. You're working at 3 o'clock in the morning because you need to get a product to the market or an order out. Or you are panicked because you haven't got enough money to pay salaries at the end of the week. And what are you going to do about it? And, you know, those are the challenges that entrepreneurs have. But you learn lessons all the time when you're doing that. And, so, I mean, I look at it now in this ecosystem. I'm very excited that we've now gone below 20% unemployment, by far the lowest in South Africa. And even I expanded is lower than any other province is narrow unemployment by far. We're like 6% lower than the nearest province in expanded unemployment to their narrow unemployment. And in our economy, it's about SMMEs. It's about those small businesses. 2 years ago, we had 330,000 SMMEs. We've now got 404,000 SMMEs in the Western Cape. They're the engine room of jobs, actually. Yeah.
So, Premier, we are going to do a deep dive on some provincial economic stuff, but let's close the loop. So how do you go from serial entrepreneur to Premier? What was your entry into politics?
Okay, so I've got my businesses running in Knysna, and maybe I should also say that while growing up on a farm, my parents were involved in politics in a way that they weren't actively involved in politics, but I mean, there was always a storeroom on our farm that had all these piles of PFP posters, and there was, you know, on election day, you know, I'll never forget as a little kid, election days were always about, you know, the whole family digging in and making sandwiches and serving tea and whatever, you know, we were that sort of family that were involved as the support. You know, the farm Bucky was always collecting posters after an election or whatever. You know, that was where I grew up. And then in 94, we had our first democratic election in South Africa. And I'm starting businesses and I'm doing my business thing. And then in 1995, we had our municipal elections, same thing. I'm busy with businesses. I'm not involved in politics. But then in 1996, we had, outside of the what we know as the metro today, we had rural elections because our municipalities weren't wall-to-wall then like they are now. And so, and I lived in Belvedere, which was outside of the Knysna municipal area. And so that meant it fell within the district municipality. And in those days, even like it was different to today. Today, we still have district municipalities, but you actually had your district areas, that your representative council. So your district council almost had two councils in one. And so.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
3 months before the election in 1996, we were at a local residents' meeting, and the question came up about this next rural election, which was 3 months away. And so I still asked a question in that meeting. I said, so which are the political parties? And they said, there's only the ANC and the National Party standing. So I said in this meeting, well, I don't want to vote for either of those parties. Let's get the Democratic Party. And we still phoned Tony Leon and said, listen, we need to be able to stand in this election. You need to put up a candidate. And basically the DP came back and said, no, we are consolidating. We've made a decision that we want to become the opposition. Remember, at that stage, Tony Leon was asked whether he wanted to serve in Madiba's cabinet. And he then said, democracy needs an opposition. So they were consolidating. So they said, we're not interested in standing. So then I said to my neighbor, I said, listen, if they can't find a political party to stand, they need to put up an independent candidate. So he said, okay. And the next meeting, which is 2 months before the election, I came to Cape Town on business. When I got back afterwards, my neighbor said, we've decided to put up a candidate. I go, that's excellent. Who? They said, it's you. I said, are you crazy? Anyway, suddenly my signage company started doing posters and banners, my vehicles were branded and we were putting up posters everywhere. And I won my seat. But I still remember going to that first district council meeting And I arrived, and the mayor, Naza, then was an ANC mayor, and his name was Alan Kok. And he welcomed me at the door of the district council. I was just, I drove up to the council in the parking, and he like, I opened my door, and he kind of like pushed me back in the car. And he said, "How's it, Alan?" I said, "How's it, Alan?" He said to me, "Listen, if we nominate you for mayor, are you happy with that?"
Said, wow, what?
In the parking lot.
I said, "Dude, I don't even know what I'm doing here yet."
Where politics happens.
Then I said, "This is where politics starts." Yeah. And I decided not to take up that offer because I really did not know why I was there yet. Mm. And that's how it started. Yeah. Then I knew, listen, wow. Dude, you have now got yourself into politics.
Sure.
And then, then I was in council for 2 years, sort of to 98. And then in 98, the year before the 99 election, I was sort of looking at my businesses and look how much time I was spending on politics, and the accounts were coming in, and I was saying, well, maybe I should spend some more time on the businesses and not on the on the politics. And then in the period of 1 week, a whole lot of political parties came and said to me, "We want you to stand for this provincial election." So I said to my wife, I said, "Listen, I'm not getting caught like last time." I said, and I came to Cape Town to come and see what happens at the provincial legislature. I went to a sitting in the legislature. I then had a meeting with James Self and with Henny Bester. Mm-hmm. Henny Bester was the provincial leader at that stage, and with James. And we had a meeting in those days. These companies. I was just we stayed at the Cape Grace Hotel. Can't do that anymore. and we had like a 2-hour meeting with them, and then on the way back to NASDA, I said, "Okay, let's try it." And went through the electoral college and did all my bit and got on the list.
Yeah. What year was this?
That was in 1999.
Wow. Okay. Wow. And I'm
when were you born?
You got it. That is officially my age now.
Some of us probably what, 6 or 5 years old.
I'm assuming you got in.
Yeah, that was also a very interesting story because at that stage we had some new candidates on the DP list, which was Nick Quinoff. Because he'd come across, he'd resigned from the National Party and joined the DP. I was number 7 on the list, and Helen was number 6. And when the election was over, I didn't get in. I never won my seat. We only got 6 seats. Mm. So then what happened was I then said, okay, well, now start concentrating on my businesses again, order some buckies and get some strategy going, and what are we going to do next? And then a few days later, I get a phone call, Henny Bester. "Alan, can you be in Cape Town tomorrow?" I said, "Well, Henny, you know, like I've been giving all this time to this election campaign. I need to now get my businesses going." He says, "No, well, it looks like we're going to put a coalition together. And with that, what Helen's going to do is she's going to come in those days you could bring a specialist into your cabinet." Mm. And Helen then resigned off the list and came in as a specialist.
And then you...
And I moved up one. Mm. And that's how I ended up in the legislature.
Wow.
But I also signed an agreement that said, but if the coalition falls, I will resign, then Helen will come back in. Because she was above me on the list. And then, I mean, it just happened that, when that coalition did fall to pieces a year later, a year and a half later, you remember we'd lost Glenn Adams. And he died to have a heart attack, and that meant the list moved up. And then and then Robin Carlyle came in. I moved up, Robin came in, and then I said, no, pass the I'll drop out to Robin. And then unfortunately, I mean, he was then in, and then not long afterwards, that coalition broke up.
Sure.
And, those starting pains of the formation of the DA. And then Robin fell out, and then obviously we had to win the next election and then come back in, and of course that's when we were the small junior partner, and we then became you know, the DA.
The DA.
And this party of governance and government.
Yeah. Premier, go for it.
Oh, no. I was just going to ask you, so walk us through your time in the provincial parliament and how that gets you to premier. Mm.
So that's also interesting, and I'm glad I'm speaking to young people in politics.
No, this is how we set it up for you today.
Yeah, no, that's great. But so my warning is don't try and become the mayor or the premier in your first term. I think everybody seems to want everything now. Build a track record, learn as you go. You know, it's about your 10,000 hours. All of those things help you. So basically, when I first got elected, I was part of a coalition government for a while. But if you look at the first two terms that I was in province, most of those were in opposition as the DA was building. And then, of course, then I had 10 years as a MEC, as a minister in government, because that was when we won the election with a 51%. And, you know, we saw ourselves growing and growing and, you know, are we going to get an outright win in the province? And, or is it going to be a coalition? We'd been in a coalition two terms earlier when we formed the DA, in those early stages of forming the DA. And then we won. We got 51%. Helen becomes the premier, and I had the privilege of being an MEC. So 10 years in opposition, you know, really, you know, doing our thing in the opposition benches, building, growing, becoming a bigger party in opposition, and you learn a lot at that stage, especially about the government.
Which portfolio were you MEC for?
Okay, so then when I became the first portfolio I held was finance and economic development. And
those I held businesses that, became handy now.
That was the obvious choice. Okay.
And so that was the first term. And then what I did was at the end of the first term, we then got re-elected. And after that election, if you remember, the Minister for Agriculture at that stage in our government was Gerard van Rensburg. And Gerard retired. And now we win the election again. And that was when I said to Helen that I think we need to create the Ministry of Economic Opportunities. And so it doesn't matter whether you've got an agribusiness or a tech business or a tourism business. You know, you've got a business and it's about jobs. And that was when I formed the Economic Opportunities Ministry. And then I relinquished the Treasury seat and I kept economic development and brought in agriculture. And it's all about the economy, all about jobs. And so that was my next term. And then at the end of that term was obviously when I was planning to run for premier. And so now I've had basically three departments. Economic development was the sort of central theme all the way through, but I've also had finance and I've also had agriculture. But a few months before the election, I elected to become the MEC for community safety. And the reason I chose that, and I mean, we all know our constitution says that a province has oversight over the police. We don't have any mandate on policing whatsoever. But the problem was you could see that crime is a big issue. And our citizens are feeling the brunt of criminal activity. And so I thought to myself that if I'm to become the premier, I need to be able to have a different model on fighting crime. And that was when I elected to go and become the MEC. So I relinquished the Economics Opportunity Portfolio. I became the MEC for community safety for a few months before the election, just to get to understand this portfolio, to you know, get to understand policing and try to understand it a bit better. And what would I do should we win this election? And then fought the election, won the election, and that was when we started with this process of saying, we actually think we need to have a devolution model. We need more power at provinces and city level. Then, alongside the City of Cape Town and the province, we devised the safety plan. That's where the LEAP officers come out. That's where the violence prevention programs come out. So we had to play, we knew we couldn't just be oversight. We have to play a much more interventionist role. And And I mean, that's where we are today with LEAP officers, 1,200 of them. Yesterday, I was actually involved with discussing with them, you know, what are your issues? How do we take those issues?
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Just to a national, to a national minister. How do we take this to the next level? And the interesting thing is now you can start to even see other premiers in other provinces are saying the same thing. We need a new policing model because crime is a massive issue for our citizens. It's a massive, massive issue. Every single day, someone's child is getting shot. Someone's family member. I mean, it's just, it is just unacceptable. So we can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again. Einstein says that's a first sign of madness. So come on, let's not be mad. Let's try something.
Let's try it. Premier, I want to, I think that's sort of sets the tone perfectly for what I think, you know, I want to ask you next, because I want to maybe play a bit of devil's advocate for a second. You know, very recent in the media, we had, you know, this three-year report that sort of made headlines on many newspapers. And, you know, from, and let me just do play devil's advocate as an opposition, you know, sort of parliamentarian and say, but Premier, why was that report then held back for 3 years? If safety was such a major concern for you as a premier, and if you had, you know, just before becoming a the premier, actually had seen the devastating impact that, you know, the police corruption and you know, under-resourcement has, you know, done to the province, why have you then held back that three-year report?
Okay, so first of all, I think the noise around the report almost seems to say that this is a report on the gangs and the SAPs and how they it's not an investigation report. It was basically me asking the ombudsman. I could have asked our legal team the same question. What can I do? Because I've just seen a judge has said the 28th gang and our top police officers are at the same top table. I mean, that's a horrendous statement for a for a judge to make. So I asked the question, what can I do about this? Because, you know, can I do something about this? And basically he came back to say, well, the most power you have is put a commission together. But, I mean, do commissions work? I don't know. We've got one going at the moment. I don't know. Do commissions work? But he said specifically in this case, a commission would not get anything right because the judge said that in a bail application, 14 people were arrested. Two of them were applying for bail. In that bail application, the judge said, the problem is the 28th gang and the police are colluding. So the ombudsman said to me, you can't put a commission inquiry. It doesn't make any sense. Then he said, but your other powers are, you can fire the, you can call for the head of the police commission. I said, well, that doesn't really make sense because I presume in this case you're referring to the previous commissioner of police. This current police commissioner is reporting to cabinet, talking to us. What else can I do? Well, we must wait until the end of that case. That case has never happened. And then the last thing in that report was the ombudsman said, the investigating officers, these are the police officers that have investigated this, and the law enforcement officers that the city of that have investigated this. I want to say that they are in danger. So, I mean, that was the most important thing, is that you need to warn both General Patekile and the mayor that you've got officials in both of your sides who's in danger, because already three witnesses have been killed, and of course any of these investigating officers are going to want to be called in to give evidence. So you need to protect them. So that's the reason why I didn't just say, well, Parliament, there's the thing, because it's got these names in it. But it was also, what can I do with this power that I've got, or do I have any power? And basically it says you can't really do very much. So then what I did was I then asked judges, asked some of our criminologists at the universities, even some international people. I said to them, so what can I do? What would you do in this case? And they said, well, do lifestyle audits of those top police officers. And that's what I've been pushing ever since. I think we've got 12 communications with three different ministers to say, we will pay for the lifestyle audits. Let's at least get that going as a first step, number one. So that's not in the report. That's that's secondary to the report. And then the second thing is, in that space, is that who is supposed to investigate police officers who there's an idea that perhaps there's some gang intervention or gang criminal activity happening between police officers and gangs? Well, that's called IPID.
Yeah.
You know, the Police Investigation Unit, independent. And they are supposed to do that investigation. Well, our MECs have been engaging over those years, in the previous term and in this term, with IPID. IPID, after 1 year, came back to us with a report on the investigation that they're looking at, and they said then they'll come back in another year.
Sure.
And then we've written to them already to say, where's the second part? Apparently now they've said to us that they will come with that list. But that's who's supposed to be investigated, number one. So everybody's saying, well, give us this report from the ombudsman. Okay, well, there it is. I gave it to everybody. There was no reason for me to make it public because it had names in it. But also, there's nothing in it.
There's nothing in it.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, because I followed it really closely, is that the people who were agitating for that report were then forced to concede that it was, in fact, exactly what you said it was. And it was a nothing burger. The thing that really upset me about the whole saga is the consistent application of pressure by certain groups on precisely the wrong body. So policing is a national competency. That is where all the pressure should be going. And yet every other day, the city, the province are catching strays. And the thing about it is, it's also coming from people who know better.
Yeah.
People who know exactly what it is. How do you, like, what do you make of the agitation around this and just the bad faith arguments?
So that is my problem. So where is the same energy on IPID? Where's the same energy on the SAPS minister, the SAPS, even the provincial commissioner or the national commissioner? Where are those questions? And at the end of the day, where's the pressure on IPID? Because in actual fact, it's IPID's job to investigate this. Why have we not got an investigation? I mean, I asked that. I asked for the ombudsman report within days. I got it within days. And then we started within days after that calling for, you know, what we were calling for, because obviously we had to do it within our constitutional mandate.
Can I
just add to your frustration? I guess we're all venting here, but, you know, the other part of that, KB, is the people that do know better than use that information to mislead those who don't know. And I think this is what we saw in the situation where, you know, when we speak about devolution, this is where it matters. Because now people who don't know and don't understand the DA's position on devolution were being basically led astray, essentially, by believing, you know, these guys were like, well, it's the Western Cape government and we need to put pressure on them, when instead the pressure needed to have gone somewhere else. And so I was, I'm deeply frustrated by that, Premier, but I also want us to really break down the devolution argument as well, because I think we need to take time on it. We need to explain it quite properly, because I think if people understand what the DA is calling for when we speak about devolution, then they would really understand that you know, it's to avoid things like this.
But let's unpack it. Even before we say devolution, let's first start by saying, so the policing system and the criminal justice system in South Africa, is it working? Yes or no? Now, so let's first start with the policing system. I think you just have to walk the streets across the Cape Flats. Just walk the streets and speak to families through the fence, over the top of the wall. I mean, they won't come out in the street, and especially not at night.
Sure.
Because they know this is gangland, and crime runs rife here.
Mm.
So the answer is that the police are not winning that war. Mm. Why are citizens, every few years, bring in the army, because everyone is frustrated because the policing system is not getting better. Yeah. It's actually getting worse. Yeah. I mean, in our police numbers and resources, are way worse. In the province, we had 20,000. When I first became the premier, at that time saying we need to be focusing differently on policing, we had 20,000 police officers. We've now got 13,000.
Sure.
And the population in that time went from 4 million citizens to 5 million citizens.
Sure.
Now, that doesn't make any sense at all. And then have a look at the management of police let's talk about these crime hotspots. Mm. You will see that they have the least police officer to population ratio.
Sure.
Now, surely in management, the first thing you go is, okay, where's crime happening? And here's my resource. Mm. All right, so let's send the resource to the crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, they don't do that. The resource is all everywhere else except where the crime is. So that's bad management.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem. Then we've got the criminal justice system. So now the police do arrest someone. It goes into the criminal justice system. That system is not working either. Mm. The backlogs. It's between the two because we've got investigators overloaded. They've got too many cases. The cases don't end up in court. When they do end up in court, they haven't been investigated properly. It gets chucked out. So also, walk on the streets. What do the people say? Oh, the guy gets arrested today. We saw him shoot the person. Mm-hmm. There's eyewitnesses. Everybody knows. Mm. The next day's back on the street.
Absolutely.
Everybody's going like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. So that system is not working. And then there's the prison system. That's also not working. I mean, everybody says it. Polsmoor is the best university if you want to be a high-level gangster.
Yeah.
You start here, you get yourself arrested, you then come out there, and now you're in management. Mm. It's the University of Crime.
Mm.
No, it has to be fixed. And all we do is we say, let's just keep doing the same thing. So that's as a sort of horizon.
Sure.
Now, what do we do? Mm. Where you're in government, what do you do? Mm. How do you do it differently? You've got to ask yourself those questions. So what should we do? What works and where does it work?
Mm.
And so I've gone to look at different violence prevention units. I mean, we use one now that comes out of Cardiff, a Welsh model. I've also seen the Scottish model, which is pretty good. We do a lot of work with the Bavarians, and that Bavarian model, that is a devolved policing model. Those police are province run.
Mm.
And so I look at that and I look at the effectiveness, and then I say, okay, well, surely we should start to look at bringing about those changes, because
at Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
That's what we've got to do. And part of that is saying, let's get power closer to where the problem is. Mm-hmm. Because the first thing, people say to me, so suddenly we say to you today, you now have power over policing. What would you do?
Mm.
Well, within the next hour, I would determine a redistribution of police forces that we do have.
Mm.
And these guys are going to go from this police station to this one because that's where the crime is. And these ones are going to go to where the crime is. That's kind of what we've done with the LEAP officers. So we've said, which are the highest crime rates across the Cape Flats? And we've chosen the top six. And 1,200 officers that we fund from the province and that are put in place by the city, because that's how the legal...
That's amazing.
Panyaza Lusufi learned that lesson.
Very local.
You must do it within the rule of law.
Yes.
He tried some other model. He could have come to us and said, so what did you do?
I wanted to actually say, you should have actually gone on X that day and actually said, I've just sent Panyaza Lusufi the blueprint from out.
No,
that would have been amazing.
Been audited a lot of times.
It is really so important because my constituency is Khayelitsha and we have some of the LEAP offices. It's incredible the resources that the province is directing our way, and it's greatly appreciated.
Yeah, but it's about a few things. It's not only about the policing side and resources.
Mm.
So it's about boots on the ground, but it's also about the technology and the analysis, because you deploy when and where needed.
Yeah.
And that's about data. Everything today is about data.
Yes.
Data and evidence.
Absolutely.
And so that's the difference. But this week I was also on the ground with SAPS officers in Delft and with LEAP officers in Delft. And where you've got a great relationship between SAPS and LEAP, you can see it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so at one stage, Delft was the murder hotspot. It's not anymore. It's starting to get better. So people there are getting a better result because of this partnership and this investment and devolved power decision making, because the LEAP offices are run by the city and they decide and make those choices. But we've got that that working together. Relation. Yeah. But you must say you can't police your way out of this problem.
Mm.
You've got to have the violence prevention stuff at the center. Yeah. That is critical. It's both.
And and Premier, you know, I've often heard you say nothing stops a bullet like a job. Your staff will often remind me of how fascinated they are when you speak about this particular topic, because it's bringing two of your passion points together: jobs and fighting crime. Why is that so important? I think, in fact, in your opening speech as a premier, you said you wanted to be remembered as the premier of jobs. Why is that so important for you?
So, I mean, crime and poverty and the criminal opportunism that is in place, the gangs and the drugs, where does that happen? Mm-hmm. And if you or in that space and someone can actually climb out of it, the only way they get out of it is because of a job.
Exactly.
And so when you create opportunity where someone knows that they're going to get an education at school, that gives them an opportunity to end up in a university or a college, and that gives them a job, you know that that person is self-sustainable going forward. And they don't have to rely on anything untoward. They're not held captive. You're giving them their power.
Mm.
And that's what our job is, really, isn't it?
Sure.
It's about, is the education system going to give you an opportunity to get a job? Is the health system enabling you to be healthy enough to complete your education and get a job?
Mm.
So everything that we do is about enabling our residents to empower themselves.
Sure.
That's what it is. And so that rises you above this underworld place, which so many people are trapped in. And we've got to break those shackles and break those barriers to let people. And that's why that job changes everything. You get a job, you've got dignity.
Yes.
You put food on your table. You feel like a worthwhile person.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. That's what's important. I think you also have dreams, right? You can actually think about saving up for a car.
Yeah.
You can get married. Like, marriage is not cheap, folks. There's just, you can look at the rest of life with it.
It gives you a life.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I had a peek at your provincial economic review and outlook. Two stats stuck out for me, and I would like you to unpack them. So on the one hand, we have the fact that unemployment in South Africa is 31.9. Western Cape, I think 19 point something, right?
0.7.
There
just
we go.
Exact. fact checking just again. just make sure.
We are well over 10% below the national average. Mm. However, the other thing that is interesting, we were talking earlier about how people think Western Cape, Cape Town, much like people think Gauteng, Joburg. But the Western Cape is more than Cape Town. Whereas Cape Town's unemployment is 25%, other regions in the Western Cape are even lower than that. I think we've got some places around 18%. We always talk about the DA difference. What does that actually mean? What is it in the Western Cape that is working and giving us these, comparatively great stats on employment?
Okay, so you must remember that I want to say that an unemployment or an employment stat is an apex stat. Mm. There's a whole lot of stuff underneath that is actually where you need to concentrate.
Data points.
Those are the things that you need to work on so that you get. And I mean, so it could be an unemployment number, you know, 19.7, or a business confidence index. It's about removing red tape. Mm. It's about your education system. It's about, and now I'm going to end off with the DA difference. So the most important ingredient to enable economic growth is infrastructure investment, because that gives you the foundation. Mm. And then on top of that infrastructure investment, it is what your other constitutional mandates are. So that is besides safety, although that is a key ingredient in creating a conducive environment for jobs. Mm. But if your roads aren't working, and that's why we make so much noise about the rail and the ports and things, because we don't have competence over them, but they are key components for investment. Energy. So we've now gone through a period in South Africa where we've had sustained power. Have a look at the medium-term budget policy statement, and what does that tell us? Suddenly, we're seeing the economy starting to lift. Yeah. Because an infrastructure failure, whether it's a water infrastructure, electrical infrastructure, road, port infrastructure, when those infrastructures fail, you can't get the economy to grow. Or let's look at it in local government terms. It's about your water, your municipal roads, your electricity connections, your sewerage connections. That's your municipal infrastructure. If you don't get the basic infrastructure right, you can't get economic growth. Mm. So, I mean, the data point that you use there is in Cape Town, where you see how much money is being invested in infrastructure in the city of Cape Town versus any other metro in South Africa. But that's why people from other metros or other provinces come to this region and they go like, wow, this is amazing. They make this sort of tongue-in-cheek comment to say, it feels like another country. And my comment to that is, this whole country can be like this.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why this Absolutely. Whole country can't be that. Because these are the basics. Mm. So if you get the basics right, the economy comes right on top of it. That is the critical component. I mean, I look at municipalities now. I look at Knysna municipality at the moment. It is, and I mean, that's my home municipality. Mm. It is such a tragedy.
It is heartbreaking.
And what's breaking at the moment? The infrastructure. The water pumps and the roads and the sewage pumps and the refuse removal. Basic municipal infrastructure not in place. And go and look at the next door town, you'll see a different town. Why? It's got proper infrastructure investment. And that is the difference. I mean, I was in Knysna the other day, and we are dealing with the problem. Piles of refuse, sewage running down the streets. And then I go to the next municipality and I catch a Go George bus. I get to a poorer community in that region, and I look at this big construction happening. What is this? Now, these are the water reservoirs, and then I see these big pipes being put in. There's infrastructure being invested. Then you know they're not going to run out of water. Mm. They're not going to have mud coming out of the pipes. The sewage is not going to run down the streets, because they're doing what a municipality should do, put the basic infrastructure. Mm. And that is the key component that a government should do. You create the environment and then maybe some interventions, and then the economy grows on the top. So our interventions here are, we've got an energy plan.
Yeah.
There's no other province with an energy plan like our energy plan. 5,700 megawatts of power in the Western Cape. That is our plan. The plan was by 2035. The latest, because you've got to measure yourself, the latest measurement will be in by 2032. Mm-hmm. By 2032, the Western Cape will be able to export energy to the Eastern Cape.
Sure.
That's where we'll be. And so we're 2,000 megawatts in. What happens? You make the commitment, you set the pathway, you bring business confidence, and you bring business, because businesses are putting the power in, not us.
Yeah.
They're investing in these power plants that are responding to municipal tenders. Mm. That's what's happening. Mm. So you're creating that confidence. So then what happens is your economy rises, your unemployment rate falls, you create hope, you put food on the table, you stop a bullet, and you give dignity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come to Joburg.
Helen's doing that.
I mean, he could have a partner. partnership.
And then the Western Cape can provide electricity as well. Come on.
We're not that far apart. I said we'll export to the Eastern Cape, but we'll export to Joburg. It's not a problem.
So Premier, I get the sense that, you know, I'm starting to get a sense of how I think your cabinet meetings are probably run. You know, this sort of Navy background of yours being very strategic, looking at the data, making sure that our decisions are based on facts so that we can actually, you know, be laser focused on our goal, which is to create more jobs in our province and to make sure that people live dignified lives. Can you share with us a little bit of insights into the cabinet that you have? I mean, you've got one of the youngest, if not the youngest, Minister for Finance in your cabinet. You know, talk to us about your cabinet and what excites you about them, actually.
Okay, so I mean, I really try to enable innovation. Mm. I mean, we actually added innovation to our set of values. So as a government, you know, from responsiveness to caring to, we've also got innovation. So we need to enable it, allow it to happen. Mm. And sometimes that's hard with our regulation and young people enable innovation. Mm. If you want to make a basic, and here's this gray-haired guy saying this, but this, if you want to make a basic change, enable it with young people. I'll first tell you, not in the cabinet, I'll give you that now, but I'll give you outside of the cabinet. When we were having this energy crisis, we have all the municipalities in the room and guys, who's doing what and what can we help with and how do we develop an overall strategy for the province? And then somebody in the George municipality says, trading on your phone. We go, exactly, that's where we've got to end up. You must be able to buy power on your phone from whichever power supply can give you the best rate.
Yeah.
But that's what's going to happen in the Western Cape. In a few years' time, you will have sustainable, cheap electricity than anywhere else in South Africa.
Sure.
Because you'll have multiple suppliers and it'll be an open trading system. Sure. But then someone in George says, oh, but we've already got a pilot running on a trading platform. They're like, wow, that's amazing. How come? Oh, no, we've got an intern in the electricity department, and this intern's brought this idea. So we're busy doing it.
Sure.
Young people.
That's amazing.
Because that's amazing. They think like that. Mm. So we've got an intern developing an energy trading system in the Western Cape, in the George Electrical Engineering Department. I mean, go to Mossel Bay, and I go there, and they've got this hotshot team that are doing the online stuff, and then they got a new logo, and I said, wow, this is like all new and fresh. They said, oh yeah, we got these three interns. They developed all of this stuff.
The keyword interns, never employ them because then they're gonna change.
Develop the intern economy.
But it's young people, you see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Creating opportunity for young people.
That's amazing.
And so then let's get back to the cabinet. So obviously what we do is the most important thing is to understand risk.
Mm.
So what are the biggest risks? Safety, energy, water. Mm. So where are the main key focus areas? What are the committees that I chair? So I chair the Safety Council. I chair the Energy Council, and now it's the Energy and Water Council. I chair it. I make sure that we've got the right people around the table making the right decisions to make that risk to go away. Because when the risk goes away, we've got a better environment for creating jobs. And then, you know, so that's what cabinet deals with all the time. What are the risks? Those are overall risks, and you'll see them built into our 5-year and our longer term planning, because that's another problem in government. We think in 5-year terms. Whenever we've done long term plans, they end up in the shelf somewhere.
Mm.
So think about our own South Africa strategies, you know, all the work that Trevor Manuel did with looking at a forward vision for South Africa. Mm. Who embraced that? No, it's in some cupboard somewhere gathering dust. So you've got to have those plans, and they've got to be embedded into what you do. And then you must have the people that do it, and they must lead it. And so each of those ministers have got to lead these programs. And yeah, we've got to get younger ministers in.
Absolutely.
And younger, but younger ministers, because there's another side to this. The one is obviously where you've got to deliver on your mandate. The voters have asked us to do something, and we took them a manifesto, and now we've got to deliver on that manifesto, and we've got to make it happen. Because that's how you create hope and opportunity and a future. And opportunity means, so let's give the youngest MEC of finance, youngest MEC the opportunity in South Africa.
That's amazing.
Why? She's going to make a difference here,
yeah.
But this is a pipeline for South Africa as well.
Absolutely.
We can see that one of these days she's probably going to venture into the national realm, and there's a good chance she can become a national minister because she's cut her teeth here.
Sure.
And so that will happen in our departments. But then go into our departments and also have a look at across our government who actually, I'm allowed to say, they've been part of young leaders.
We just had a graduation.
But anyway, let's get back to the point. There is such amazing innovation coming out and to tell those stories. So, you know, whether it's in education, and we have got rapid school build, where we're building schools at 65 and 70 days for 500 learners. That happens if you're building a second school on an education property.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or what was normally taking 4 and 5 years from planning to fruition is now taking 2 and 3 years.
Yeah.
So we've really cut the red tape, cut the systems, put almost like war rooms in place to make sure that you get those schools delivered.
That's amazing.
So we deliver more schools than any of the other big provinces that have got more people than us, like way more. Or then in health, we've got a new program called the Kulisa Care Program, which is focusing on stunted babies.
Mm.
Now, if you think about the conversation on crime, if a baby is born underweight and doesn't get rectified, that child does not have the right nutrition in the formation stages in those first 1,000 days.
Mm-hmm.
That child will battle in school, will not perform, will have to be held back, might not, eventually drops out of school. The chances are that child's going to become involved in gangs probably is 80%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're setting the child up to fail. So this project, if we can get that to win, I mean, we'll not only change South Africa through that project, we'll change Africa and many other countries in the world because we'll be able to use the same model.
Yeah. And so is that 600 and voucher coming from our budget as the province, or is national actually?
No. This is a provincial program and it's partnered with the DG Murray Trust. So we've got a NGO partner.
Mm.
We partnered with ShopRite because they do the credit card voucher system.
Yeah.
Mm. And they've got on that you can only buy those 9 nutritional high protein products for gaining weight of the mom and the child. And then our health department.
Sure.
And that is the system. And then our universities, because we've got to make sure we monitor and evaluate and tweak and adjust as it goes, because we've got to learn.
Sure.
And that's amazing. Or we're busy with another program, also in the violence prevention space. It's called Planet Youth. So we know that 13-year-olds, if you can't intervene around there, then you can actually lose your child at that stage into the gangs, into drugs, into alcohol, into whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done an interview now of 50,000 13-year-olds in this province, 123 schools, based on the criteria that we've learned from other countries. And now we are starting this program. We will continue to do these interviews every second year, but now we know that this percentage already involved with drugs or alcohol or a parenting issue or whatever those issues, and we can start to intervene. Yeah. This is a massive data-based, evidence-based learning system for intervention into making sure we're getting better education outcomes, creating opportunity for a future for a young person.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go through department after department, mobility, giving vouchers to, you know, young first-time job seekers or interviews.
Yeah.
You can go into, you know, any of these departments. Mm-hmm. There's innovation coming out.
Absolutely.
There's new ways of doing things. And, you know, that's the culture in our organization. And then maybe I was going to say, and that's the last thing I'll say about an organization, because remember, these are big businesses. They are big organizations. So I still think we're the only government that does it, although I know the Auditor General does it now as well. But we are part of Topco 100. We are part of a competition, global competition, as the best place to work in the world.
Sure.
Wow.
So, because if you go and have a look at the top performing companies in the world, they work on the culture of their organization. And what is culture? Yeah. Culture is brand. Brand is how you are seen by your customers and how your customers, how you treat your customers. And everybody's got different models. You know, Richard Branson always says, look after your staff and they will look after the customer. The next company says, customer is king or customer comes first. But it's above that nexus. And so we started a culture journey a few years ago. 3 years now we've been entered into the best place to work in the world competition.
Sure.
We are, we compete with the 1,700 businesses on the African continent, and now for the third year in a row, we're in the top co. We're not at the top yet. I said, let's enter it. We'll come last once, and then we'll start to climb.
Hang on. So is this the Western Cape government that is in the top 100?
Yeah, we compete with businesses.
Wow.
That is impressive.
We compete with businesses. And that measures the culture of your organization.
That's incredible.
And for a government, sometimes that's tough because we don't sell phones.
Yes.
We sell education and health.
Yeah, services.
Wellness.
Yeah. We sell social services. We sell economic opportunities. We sell so many things. And each of those departments are different brands and they are different cultures. Mm. But how do they all show up? Mm. And that's the for you.
For you.
That's where that comes from. It's who are we? We're a government. Mm. Who are we for? We're for you, the customer, that's the amazing. Client, the citizen, the resident of this province.
But Prem, I'm so interested now to, you know, since the government of national unity, how you are interacting with it and you know, has it been any different in comparison to before the election to now? Anything interesting that you can share with us, unknown secrets?
Okay, so number one, high level, there's definitely a different attitude, which is really great. I mean, you know what the government of national unity did was it almost gave permission for officials to engage above the line with the Western Cape. I'll be walking down the passageway and I'll look in the boardroom and then I'll look again and there's the, you know, the DG of some other province and he's busy engaging.
Oh.
And I go, how's it? And okay, great. He's got permission almost because there's this government of national unity. Or my DG will say, listen, I'm not going to be here tomorrow. I say, are we going to the Northern Cape because the three Cape's DGs are all meeting together with our teams because we're talking about green hydrogen. Or it's like, it's almost like helped us
collaboration
go to a different level of collaboration, which is, it like almost gave permission. I think people were scared before and because of politics. They were like, we can't be seen to be working with the Western Cape. That's and perhaps that we've always proactively tried that, but now it's given us a better opportunity to engage. I mean, I don't know if you saw the other day, we had the full KZN cabinet and all their officials here in Cape Town with our officials and our cabinet engaging with each other. What do you do here? How do you fix this? No, we try this. Oh, that's a good idea. And we share information. That's how you get better, right?
Absolutely.
And then at national. So definitely there's a different attitude and a different mindset. You know, when you pick up the phone, there's a different. It's way better.
Sure. Yeah. He's not persona non grata anymore.
No, I'm not the enemy anymore.
You're not besties, just no, not, we're not the enemy
yet. But and then the cool thing is that we've also got ministers that you know this is my minister. But it also works across the board. So, I mean, I've actually got a meeting this afternoon with a national minister. I've never had so many national ministers in our cabinet room before.
Sure.
So they're in Cape Town. They said, I'll pop in. I'll come and see you.
Wow.
You
know, it's like, that's amazing.
That has never happened before.
And to be fair, is that from other parties as
well? Yes.
Yeah. That is incredible.
That's amazing. I mean,
I was just going to ask. So earlier on, you were mentioning all the things you have to sell as the premier. And one of the things you recently had to sell is us as an investment destination. Do you want to look? I saw your smile. What would you like to tell us about the investment summit?
Okay, so, you know, obviously you've got to get the ecosystem right for an economy. You know, have you got enough energy? Does the water work? Does the roads work? You know, et cetera, et cetera. Which is our daily work. Have you got a skilled workforce? Are they healthy? But nothing will work unless you can attract investment. Because investment is how you grow your economy.
Yeah.
People invest in businesses. You've got entrepreneurs with great ideas. That great idea never gets anywhere unless it gets investment and can go to the next idea, can grow and employ people. So that's what we say our apex project in the Western Cape is growth, and that means investment, and then jobs, which means enabling you, the resident, to get that job that comes with the growth.
Absolutely.
So now how do you get investment? So we have an investment summit. But I must say that we have this discussion and Ivan Meyer's got to lead it, and because that's his job, he's the minister. But I said, I don't want this big thing at a convention center where all the politicians talk and we then talk about the investment pipeline that's been and that's where it ends. No. We must have a proper investment. That means you've got to have a deal book.
Yeah.
What projects are there? I don't want to talk about something that someone invested last month in. Mm-hmm. I want to say, here's a whole list of projects that we need investment to get off the ground. And then I need a whole lot of people who are potential investors.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get that right, then we can have an investment conference. And I must say, kudos to the team. They pulled off an amazing investment summit. And the reason I know it's an amazing investment, not because of the investment numbers or the deal book size, it is because of even during the summit, I had corporates coming to me saying,
"Wow,
can we be the headline sponsor of the next one?"
Oh, wow.
In other words, we'll pay.
Yeah, this is great.
We'll pay. Nice. When people are prepared to put money down, you know, hang on a second.
You're doing it great. Yeah.
But, so I think we've got a good track record. In the last 5 years in South Africa, 404,000 jobs, new jobs in South Africa in the last 5 years. 360,343 of those jobs in the Western Cape.
That's 400,000
jobs in South Africa. 360,000 of those jobs come from one province.
That's
to be clear, I'm just making sure my maths is not defeating me. That's 90% of the jobs.
Why? How come?
But well, tell me, Premier.
So you've got to have the right ecosystem. You've got to be able to have business confidence.
Yes.
And so we then said, let's have this conference.
Yeah.
Let's set a target, 200 billion.
Yeah.
The target. And you must come with a 50 billion project or more. Then we saw in the rural areas that some of these guys think 20 billion. So then we said, okay, rural areas 20 billion, metro 50 billion. 200 billion target. We had an original, and then we also then asked outside intervention to say, you need to analyze these projects. So the stock exchange, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, Johannesburg Stock Exchange.
The Cape Town didn't launch.
You know the Johannesburg Stock Exchange has got an office in Cape Town, but
we don't have a stock exchange.
There is a Cape Town Stock Exchange.
It's online.
The modern stock exchange is
I feel like it's Western Cape against Joburg.
But hold that point. That is a very critical point. I want to talk to that. But so we set a target of 200 billion, 110 projects in that deal book. We ended up with just short of 500 billion in deals. 50 billion was committed to at the summit.
Yeah.
We then said we want a partner. We had an electronic booking system. The company that runs the booking system says the normal average of business-to-business bookings in these cases are 1.5. So in other words, a project gets about 1.5 meetings. Mm. About 3 days before the conference, we had 4.5 as the number. We had 1,800 meetings in those 3 days.
Two and a half days.
1,800 meetings between projects, and we got a list of people who said, "I'm sorry, I missed it. Can we be?" So we'll probably do the next one in 2 years' time again. But it was massively successful, and I'm hugely grateful to every single one of those officials that spent weeks, months.
I can imagine
putting this together, and of course, you can only do it if you've got your investors. But
this is happening on the back of the G20 being in South Africa as well. We have the presidency this year, and probably ending today, tomorrow, actually.
No, this weekend.
This week.
Weekend.
And it's so fascinating because, you know, I think there's been a lot of discussion in the media about this, a lot of countries pulling out as well. I mean, if you had to be the special advisor to the president today, what did your advice be to him as he prepares to also, you know, put up South Africa as the destination of investment, you know, to the world?
Mm. I think we've got to be quite clear on our vision, quite clear on what we're trying to achieve. Now, sometimes that's South Africa's problem, is that, you know, we say one thing today and then we say something else tomorrow. We've got to be quite consistent and quite clear because that builds business confidence. Mm. We've got to showcase, there's one thing about South Africa is that cheapers, we've got amazing people. Mm. And that's probably one of our biggest assets, or our people. We're going to showcase those people with a clear vision. And then, of course, alongside the G20, which is the political, which this weekend will complete. But there's also all the work that's gone into the B20. And at the end of the day, the economy is driven by the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what you've got to show from a political point of view, is clear vision and that there's commitment to enabling the environment.
Mm.
That is what business wants.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've now come off the grey listing. Mm-hmm. We've now got to show a clear strategy that we want to be out of junk status. Yeah. We want to be proper investment status. Mm. There's no doubt that, you know, South Africa is that country of opportunity for Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We play a big role in Africa's future, and Africa is actually the continent of the future.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to be clear about it as South Africa, is that this is the launch pad. We've got key partnerships across Africa, and then together this continent mm-hmm. Has got to be what most big global businesses have in their horizon, is their Africa strategy. What is their Africa strategy? If they don't have an Africa strategy, they're going to lose out.
Yeah.
And then what is our strategy? It's got to be clear. It's got to be articulated in a way that business understands it and our citizens understand it. That says, you know, if we want to be part of that future, you know, we've got to be educating properly. We've got to be taking the right choices and making the right choices at our universities and setting ourselves up for that future and think longer term. Don't think short term.
And I think South Africans need to root for South Africa as well. I think, you know, we have to stand behind South Africa right now more than ever. You know, I think looking at where our economy is going and, you know, seeing the differences that are starting to slowly start happening, South Africans need to be behind South Africa. I think that's the most powerful thing that we can also see. So I think also with people not coming to our country, like, South Africa still got it. We still here, and we still believe in our country, and we're going to make it work no matter what.
So why do we always have to take an international person, and a foreigner that arrives and goes like, wow.
Exactly.
And you go like, let me tell you five things that are crap about it. No.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, let me tell you what's so amazing about it.
Exactly.
So maybe we should all start with that. When we are around that braai fire, that Gally Blik this weekend, why? And somebody starts complaining, because that's what we're very good at. Mm-hmm. Yes. South Africans, we love complaint. When someone complains, say, actually, let's just stop it right there. We'll pick up the complaint shortly, but let's just take three things that are great about this country, and then we'll pick up the complaint. Let's just flip it a little bit. Yeah. So, what's great about Jersey?
Helen.
Yeah, well, that's a good answer.
I mean, Premier, to be fair, I think the reason why South Africans focus on the negative is because, to some degree, you can't fix the problem if you don't identify the problem, right?
Sure.
However, I will also concede that there has to be a forward-looking, positive vision.
Mm.
If you were magically president tomorrow, how do you take what you've done here? The growth, the jobs, the investment, how do you take that national? What do you actually do?
So, I mean, we were just joking now, but it's actually in all seriousness.
Sure.
If Joburg doesn't work, the Western Cape doesn't work. Mm. Johannesburg and Gauteng is the engine room of sub-Saharan Africa. We have to make it work.
Mm.
It's like, this is not an option.
No. Yeah.
We have to make it work. So that's number one. You know, identify, that's number one. Fix Joburg and Gauteng. That's what we've got to do. And then, of course, it's about saying the same thing about KZN and the Western Cape, because these are the three big engine room provinces. But then make sure that our neighboring provinces are also part of this of this program, because, you know, we've got to make sure that we lift this tide for everybody in our country. But primarily the engine room. Let's get this in. The engine room's misfiring, you know. Come on, let's give it a service. Let's tweak it up a little bit. Let's get its revs up to where it should be.
Sure.
Because that's what we've got to get right.
Can I summarize that as vote DA? If you want to fix Johannesburg, vote DA.
Get the DA in government.
Well, I promise you, you don't want the government that's running NASDA at the moment running Joburg. You need to be able to say, well, who's got the track record?
Absolutely.
Okay, there's only one party with a track record.
Absolutely.
And take those models. I mean, it's not, you know, okay, you can't do exact cookie cutters, because that's the reason why we say devolution of policing power. So they've got to be refined for, you know, what works in the Free State is going to be different to what works in the Western Cape. But you've got to take the basic recipe. And that's what Joburg needs. It needs the basic recipe. Yeah. So we've got to get Helen in. We've got to build a competent team.
Absolutely.
And we've got to start to get the basics right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because when the basics right, then you've built the launch pad. Yeah. And then everything just goes.
I mean, you were on the DA's negotiation team for the GNU. Was there ever a moment during that time when you actually sat back and you thought, wow, I mean, what an opportunity we have to fix this country, and how exciting it actually is to be part of that as well.
So, I mean, often I should pinch myself. Like, I'm actually sitting here talking about our great country and having this discussion. Am I actually sitting here? And then sometimes we'd have this little discussion afterwards. Okay, so where are we on percentage for success? You know, are we going to succeed in this or aren't we? Yeah. And it was amazing how those, depending on how it went that day.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be like huge optimism, and the next thing it would be like, oh my goodness, there's no way we're going to break this. I had to pinch myself. You know, there was a decision made before our time to say that as a party we want to become the official opposition, and we set that path and we became the official opposition. Then there were decisions made to say we have to now become a party of government.
Mm.
And we've been doing that consistently, and the track record shows that we actually have delivered on that governance and government promise, and we've just got to keep that trajectory going. And now we need to turn Johannesburg. I mean, we need to take the bigger metros, get those majorities, and start to govern properly. And South Africa will then be the launch pad to prosperity, to opportunity, and to actually putting South Africa in its rightful place.
Sure.
Random question. You're actually sitting on a treasure trove of information. Any plans to write a book?
That's a yes.
I love that he can't hide his smile.
That's a yes. That's a yes.
Is there a book in the works?
There could be,
There could be.
I mean, on the topics of books, I'm fascinated to find out or to know what did Elon Musk's biography actually teach you about leadership? Because, I mean, I read it and I thought, what a horrible guy, but what a great leader, you know? What was your takeaway?
So the one thing about, I mean, definitely not my style of leadership at all.
Yeah.
I'm the exact opposite to that. You know, I believe in building teams and building people in those teams. You know, some of those things that he did was pretty nasty. But what was, for me, the standout was the innovation. Mm. The innovation, and also, like, there was that solid work ethic, you know, kick the beanbag and I'll carry on working, you know.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that part where he talks about SpaceX, and they're gonna have to release the fuel as it gets into space. They released the fuel component, and they could only buy that switchgear from NASA at hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he said, "No, but that's like a garage remote. You got like $200. You go make it happen. That's the cool stuff, you know. Make things work. Make it happen.
Yeah.
Just you know,
get in and get,
drag in some resources and but not make it this massively expensive thing. And and that innovation, and that's disruption in government and government's old style of doing things. You know, can you make, and sometimes that's hard, it's hard to enable and allow innovation to happen because we can't buy it. We don't have a procurement model or a system, or and so you've got to enable that system to be able to do it. That's hard.
I think sometimes we're so obsessed about process and not outcome in government, and
but surely that's where red tape and ease of doing business, that's that's the, because it applies to everybody. I mean, we do it because it's outward facing, we're saying to business, tell us what's getting in your way, but we use it internally as well. I mean, I think the day that Jordan put that stupid button on the on the every official's computer system, excellent, because an official themselves have got the power to say, no, this is a stupid rule. It's there's a guy called Vishen Lakhiani. I don't know if you know him, if you read any of his books, but he calls them brules, bullshit rules. They're brules, and sometimes we've got brules in the way, and we do them because, you know, it's the default. You know, we've got corruption. So what do? Let's put a whole lot of rules in place. The corrupt guys didn't follow the rules in the first place. So all we're doing is we're increasing the rules, but the crooks, the crooks just keep on doing it. They don't follow the rules. Those that do follow the rules just becomes more difficult.
That also reminds me of the stupid rule you brought up. In
that's
Cape
the one
Do-
that's it. Just mentioned. Is it the one?
What did I call it?
Is it the rule? The same thing.
That's a different one. It is the stupid rule.
Rule is a red button on the right hand side of our city internal page. And you, whenever you come across a stupid rule, you press that button, you submit it, and you know, the mayor can take that recommendation and remove it. You know,
Prem, just a quick one. You know, so TikTok. I know you have a TikTok, so I'm sure you follow some of the conversations. Yes, Prem has a TikTok. Side eye to you, KB. I'm joking. So, Prem, just a question on your side. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation going on TikTok, specifically. Shout out to the Gen Zs. I'm asking some of your questions. You know, there's been a huge conversation around affordability and you know, not making it about Cape Town, but I suppose it is Cape Town and other places being expensive. I don't know if there's anything you'd say, maybe.
So property is expensive.
No.
The shopping basket is not as, but that's generally on a fair par. Definitely the things to do are much cheaper in Cape Town because you can go to the beach, you can walk on the mountain. There are a lot of things to do, but property is expensive. And I keep on saying to our municipalities that is a result of supply and demand.
Absolutely.
And this is the hard thing, because a municipality can't just put your foot on the gas, increase the supply. But a big deterrent in supply is obviously residents, people who've already got their place, because they actually want that property growth to grow as fast as possible because they've invested in an investment. But our growth is too high. I mean, there's only one standout metro in South Africa, and that's Cape Town. If you remove inflation and you take the value of property in all metros in South Africa in the last 15 years, the property in every other metro has decreased in value by between 18 and 21%. In Cape Town, it's increased by 19%. So it's just above, exponentially getting worse or better, depending on which side of the fence you're on. But if you're looking for affordability, it's getting much worse. So we have to increase supply. That's why we are doing things like the Conradi housing model, like these inner city high-rise housing models. But we also have to enable the private sector to do the same thing. Now, it's not as if it's not happening. There's cranes everywhere. But we've got to increase it even more. The problem is that the speed to increase slows because of the, I want to say, the NIMBYs. A lot of, not in my backyarders. But I always say in Pinelands, people in Pinelands became YIMBYs. They first wanted to go to court. They hated this idea of Conradi and these high-rise buildings. But now they're going like, wow, this is amazing. This is exactly what we want.
So, Premier, because of the NIMBYs, I think the supply and demand model is much harder. can I put to you the Zoran Mamdani model? I think we should have rent control, and I think we should ban Airbnb. Tell me why my ideas are fantastic.
Okay, so rent control is sort of part of what these buildings in the middle of the city are, because they're social housing.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what we're doing in the city. They're hard to manage because we've got social housing
in
the city.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just drive up Philip Hosanna and all of those apartments on your left-hand side.
Stienberg in Military Road.
Oh, social housing. Mm. The problem is they're sometimes third generation and the guy that lives in there is a medical doctor earning a fortune. And he shouldn't be in there.
Instead of relinquishing it for those.
So there's problems that come with it. Yeah. But yeah, and these new buildings at Leo Leopold down at Founders Garden, that's exactly what that is. On the Airbnb model, you need to be able to base it on data. Now, in the housing space in Cape Town, it's less than 1%.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's what we need to do. It's like a knee jerk. Mm-hmm. I also believe that it's about markets. So if you look at Airbnb, it's amazing how many hotels use Airbnb as lastminute.com, which is quite interesting. And it's actually here more than in other places because we have a fast-growing tourism market. Yeah. It's outpacing the construction. We have too few hotels, in actual fact.
Yeah.
Our booking levels, even in wintertime now, is very high. So that's great news for jobs and the economy. There's a full report actually that's available on Airbnb. I believe the market sorts it out. We've been in this place before where people are going, these Airbnbs are forcing us out and charging too much. But what happened a few months later, there was an oversupply. And what happens when there's an oversupply in the market, the market fixes it.
Yeah.
So suddenly those people who'd invested in Airbnb were going, maybe we had to put it on the open market for full-time rental.
Yeah.
And those B&Bs became long-term rentals.
Yeah.
And then when they go, hang on a second, there's a little change. Mm. And then they maybe sell it. And remember, Airbnb is not a, or we're just talking about a booking engine, whether it's Airbnb or Lekkerslap or
Uber,
whatever these things are, or Uber and Bolt. And they're just booking engines enabling supply and demand.
Yeah.
And so I believe that market forces sorts these things out and creates the level field. And government's job is not to regulate and legislate. Government's job is to look at the issues and then enable. So at the moment, what we should be enabling is increasing square meterage. Mm. That's what we should be enabling.
There we go.
Yeah.
Across the board.
And I think you know that's something very important. And I wanted to ask that question because it is quite a hot topic. But then Prem, can you just tell us in terms of indigence in the province and what the province is doing to support indigent families and individuals in the province?
It was really great to see before Indigence, homeless people and seeing the investment, hundreds of millions now being spent in making sure we got sufficient homeless shelters, because post the pandemic, it became another pandemic.
Yeah.
Yes.
So many people lost their jobs, lost their income, had no place to stay. And slowly but surely you're seeing that come right. But of course, that's also a painful process because there's evictions that come with it and all sorts of other issues that come with it. And then, of course, you've got indigents. And so often, people who should be on an indigent register are not. And in actual fact, some of our municipalities, because you know that they make application to National Treasury based on their indigent registers, and they don't have sufficient indigents on their registers, so they're not claiming the money that's actually due to them. And that is an issue. We've got to get that balance right. And people have the right to be on an indigent register.
Absolutely.
And if you're not, come on, let's just get that right. And that's about us as a political party, our councillors, making sure we're getting the people registered that are supposed to be, because that's what it's there for.
Yeah.
It is about support to people who can't afford it.
Yeah.
And we've got to make sure that those tools are in place.
Yeah.
And then we're responding. But then again, I come back to, of course, it's impossible to build a house for everybody and give everybody a grant and then everything will be happy ever after. The best antidote is a job.
Absolutely.
There's a group of people that comes here annually and they bring lots of money and help create jobs, the tourists. Now, they're going to flood the CBD. However, we want you to tell us some of your favorite places outside of Cape Town. where should our tourists be going in the Western Cape?
So I call it now of late, I don't call it the tourism industry, I call it the experiential industry. Mm. Because that's what it is. It's about experiences. You're selling experiences. Mm-hmm. And our real experiences here are our people, our culture, our music,
food.
Our food, our lifestyle, our what we do as human beings. So, you know, of course, I mean, I think all of our regions have got such unique offerings. So the Garden Route is so different to the Karoo, which is so different to the Weskus again. And then, of course, you got the Wynand. So, and then, of course, there's the Overberg. So all of our regions have got their uniquenesses. Mm. And, you know, you've got to make sure you come and do the basics in the city, but you get out and get into our rural areas. And so my favorites, sure, that is hard. you know, I love the open skies at night of the Karoo, the stars, and the get into the Tankwa, and at nighttime just lie there and look up. It is actually so bright.
Right.
It's quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
One day I hope to be able to go there and look back at what this earth looks like from space.
That's amazing.
But the stars. I mean, the Garden Route. Of course, I've got to be cycling. So,
you know, of course.
You have to go and cycle our gravel roads and cycle along our sort of forest pathways. Mm. And that's amazing in the Garden Route. But it's also amazing to see how things are developing. I mean, you look at a cruise line terminal has now been built in Mossel Bay.
Amazing.
Because more and more cruise liners are pulling into the bay.
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
There's one at the bay now.
Very interesting.
And then, of course, when you get to Mossel Bay or that region, that's about the origins of man. And, you know, South Africa has, and Gauteng has the cradle of humankind, Mrs. Pless. 3 million years ago.
We still have stuff, guys.
Yes. So Mrs. Pless, 3 million years ago, humanoid.
Yes.
One of the first evolution of man.
Whew.
Then man modernized, because that wasn't modern man. Modern man was about song and culture and painting and innovation and hunting with tools. And so everybody thought that happened about between 45 and 60,000 years ago in the Mediterranean region of Europe. Well, sorry for them. It didn't happen there. It happened here. And it happened in the Southern Cape region down to the Overberg region. And it happened 125,000 years ago, long before Europe. And it happened here on these coasts where we started having nutrition from hunter-gathering and from the oceans with the omegas. Mm. And our brain developed much quicker. And so that's when language, song.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
The messaging on the on the cave wall. So we got hundreds of scientists working on these on this coastline at the moment on that modernization of man. And then at that time on the planet, we had Neanderthals in Europe. We had human activity in the west coast of Africa. And then we had this activity down here in the southern part of Africa. They can't really trace future movement of the West African development. It kind of, maybe it had a virus or something, but you saw it to a certain age and then you didn't see it anymore. But then what happened is the Southern African development and modernization moved up through Africa, clashed with the Neanderthals, moved over to the east, over the top and to the west. And that's why it doesn't matter where you are in the world, if you do a DNA test, you'll find African DNA in everybody.
In there, yeah.
They all come from here.
Yep.
So that's why I always say that most people in the world hang the map upside down, because we're at the top and not them.
There we go.
Number one. And number two, any tourist that comes here, we say to them, welcome home, because this is where it all comes.
That's amazing.
Not Joburg.
So, let's do a quick round of questions. So, one word answers. Favorite vegan dish?
Roast cauliflower.
Book or audiobook?
I've never had time for audiobooks, but
Or podcast.
Or podcast.
Plug us in.
I think since the pandemic, the book that influenced me the most is called Rescue. by Professor Golden. He's at Oxford University, and he wrote about is the pandemic our first world war or second world war, and the resetting of the planet. And quite frankly, I think it's the first world war. We didn't learn enough lessons, and we're now on the way to, you know, I don't know what. You know, after the second world war, we developed the United Nations. We brought countries out of dictatorships into democracy. The world changed in the last 80 years. Unfortunately now, after the millennium, we kind of went over the top of that S-curve. But that's rescue. Sorry. You said one word.
What is the longest you've ever cycled?
In one day?
Yeah.
209 kilometers, and I'm doing it again on Saturday.
Wow. Prem, I'll join you in January. I'll be with you. I'll give you a call, January.
Oh, my word.
What's your favorite song?
Sure. I've got a new one.
Okay.
Ooh. It's called Cosa Nostra, but it hasn't been released yet.
Oh.
So
artists probably send it to you and like, Prem, what do you think? Or
I've been to a listening party.
Oh, wow.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Zolani.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Cannot wait. And then what's a skill you'd still like to learn?
I was going to say play a musical instrument, but I'm not allowed to. So,
what you is have to explain that. Did your wife ban
I'm
you?
Not even allowed to sing in the shower. So. A skill that I'd still like to learn. Snow skiing.
Okay.
I mean, you did volunteer with the NSRI, so I think you have that adventurer vibe.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, that'd be cool. That's a nice one. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I can water ski, and I can abseil, and I've done skydiving, and I've done paragliding.
You're up there with Richard Branson.
Prem, not to get serious, but 2026 elections are coming up. Just to our audience, our viewers, our listeners, what is your message heading into this local government election? Very important one. Something that I think all of us really are hoping that we could turn the tide in some of our municipalities, basic services, and the basics for the people.
So you know, people say you must vote with your brain or vote with your heart. I'm saying vote with your heart and your brain. There's only one party with a track record in government, and that is the DA.
Absolutely.
I mean, don't be silly about this. Mm-hmm. This is about your children's future. Mm-hmm. This is about our future as South Africa. Come on. Be smart with your brain and your heart.
Love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the premier of the Western Cape, the best run province in South Africa. Testing you guys. Premier Ellen Windy, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much.